Again, we've been looking at the Tehillim that we recite on Shabbos. And the first one that we looked at, just to remind you, was something that we actually don't recite, except Hasidim recite it. And that was 107, Kuf Zayin, which talked about the four people who are rescued from danger. And they have to thank Hashem, and that is the halachic source of Benjin Goymel. And the Baal Shem Tov was Mesakein, that should be recited on as you enter Shabbos, the Mincha before Shabbos, because Shabbos too is a refuge for people who are in spiritual danger. We then looked at Tzaddik Beis 92, which is designated specifically as Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos. It is the Song of Shabbos, and again, even before there was an official Kabbalah Shabbos ceremony, you went straight from Mincha to Ma'ariv. The Rambam records that there was an old minhag that was much earlier than him, that people would welcome Shabbos by the quite logical psalm of Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos. And there, if you recall, without going over everything, other than the words Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos, it's not about Shabbos at all, really. It's primarily about why do the wicked prosper, why do the righteous suffer, and the fact that this is only temporary and eventually Hashem will bring redemption to the righteous. And the connection to Shabbos on one level is simply because, according to one shita in the Medrash, Adam Harishain Moshe Rabbeinu composed Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos when he negotiated with Paro to give the Jews a day off. This is before he left Mitzrayim. And as they had time to pray and meditate and contemplate, they were wondering, why is it that we suffer so much? And this was a psalm of comfort and nechama. Now, right after Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos, which is Tehillim 92, is Tehillim 93, which we recite Friday night right after Mizmor. In other words, it's simply the next kapitel. And it's a very, very short one. It begins with Hashem Molach. And you'll obviously note that the part two of the psalm, in other words, the second psalm that is recited, happens to also be the daily shir of Friday. So it's interesting that Friday morning we recited Hashem Molach. And then Friday night, after Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbos, we recite it again. So you actually recited it, well, it's technically not the same day, because one is Friday, one is Shabbos, but you know, in a secular sense, you've recited it twice on the same day. Now, let me first mention why this is called the Shir Shol Yom. Why would this be the Shir of Friday, before we get to Shabbos? A little word, first of all, about what do we mean by, this may be obvious, forgive me, what do we mean by Shir Shol Yom? We know that every single day in the Beis HaMikdash there was a Korban Tamid that was brought in the morning and a Korban Tamid that was brought in the afternoon. Korban Tamid Shol Shachar, Korban Tamid Shol Bein Arbayim, it was one lamb. And along with the lamb was a libation of wine that was poured on the Mizbeach after you sacrifice the lamb. That's called Nisuch Hayayin. When the wine is being poured on the Mizbeach, that is when the Levim would say their Eshira, they would say a song of praise. So the famous statement, Ein Shira Ela B'Yayin, is not referring to, Stam, I'm sitting at the table and I'm singing, I got to have a drink. Rather, it's referring very specifically to this halachic rule that the Shira in the Beis HaMikdash was Mechayev, I'm sorry, that the Nisuch Hayayin in the Beis HaMikdash was Mechayev, a Shira of the Levim. Now the Levim, when they were Isaac and Shira, there were two types of musicians. There were vocalists, who would sing the words, and there were instrumentalists who would play the instruments. Even on Shabbos they would play the instruments, because the Avodah is Deicha Shabbos. Now there is a machlokas in the Gemara itself, if the main mitzvah of Shira is the vocal music, or the main mitzvah of Shira is the instrumental music. And the nafkamina is, did you have to have a Levi as a musician? If the Iker Shira is the singing, then only the singers have to be Leviim, And the people who played the harps, they could be anybody. They could even be Evid Kananim and the like. If, on the other hand, the mitzvah of Shira is including the instrumental music, then you'd have to have a Levi do that as well. Now, obviously, the mitzvah of Shira is a Torah requirement, but the content of the Shira could not possibly be a Torah requirement because they sang Tehillim, and a lot of Tehillim were not written yet. Now, Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos perhaps was written, but a lot of them were written by David HaMelech. So the answer must be that insofar as the Torah is concerned, Shira could be anything. You could make up your own poem, meaning the Torah is not makbed on a nusach, but it simply says part of the sacrificial system is there would be a Shira to Hashem. So the Shir Shel Yom is simply the Shir that was sung in the Beis HaMikdash on that particular day of the week. Right? So when we say the Shir Shel Yom, we are actually doing two different things. One thing we're doing is commemorating the avoda in the Beis HaMikdash that had that particular Shira. The second thing we're doing, by the line we say before Shir Shel Yom, we say Hayom Yom Rishon Bashabas. Hayom Yom Sheni Bashabas. Now that's not part of the Shira, that's a hakdama to the Shira. But the point of that is that we are makayim the mitzvah of remembering Shabbos every single day. When the Torah says, Zochor Shom HaShabbos Tekadshei, the fourth commandment, remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy, this doesn't only mean Kiddush, although that is indeed the makor of Kiddush, but it means every single day one is supposed to think about Shabbos, and that is why, I'll give you a second, that is why in Judaism, in Hebrew, we do not have distinct words for Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. We always refer to it in terms of Shabbos. Yom Rishon means the first day towards the Shabbos, right? Yom Sheni, the second day towards the Shabbos. So some had a minhag, or Shlomo Zalman had a minhag, Orbach had a minhag, that before he would say the Shir Shel Yom, he would say that he's hineni muchan mezuman to be makayim the mitzvah zochor es yom haShabbos lekadshei. Right, remember the day of Shabbos to keep it holy. Hayom yom rishayin la Shabbos. Yeah, do you want to say?
Is it also a mitzvah in the other five
tzechiros? Well, there's six tzechiros. Well, it is a mitzvah, let me put it this way, it is certainly a mitzvah to remember them. Whether you have to verbalize them every day, it technically would not be a mitzvah. But it's a good idea to say them, because that way you know for sure that you have remembered them, at least for a moment. But Shabbos is certainly one of them. Now, based on that, let's just focus on, we're not doing the Shir Shel Yom, we're just doing Tehillim Tzadik Gimel, which is the second thing that you say Friday night, but you said it Friday morning as well. So let me just mention, why is it the Shir Shel Yom of Friday? Because Friday is, of course, the creation of Adam. It is the last day of Hashem's 6 days of creation. And the Tehillim begins, Hashem Malach. Hashem was the king. We'll talk about a little later why it's past tense. Malchus. Malchus, Hashem was not a melech until Adam was created. Why is this so? Hashem is the ruler over everything. So the Vilna Gaon writes that we have two different words for a monarch or a ruler. We have a word that's called Moshel, and we have a word that's called Melech. And the difference is, a Moshel is a dictator who imposes his will on you, whether you like it or not. A Melech is someone who is actually accepted by the people as a ruler. Now, Lav Dafka in a democratic election, certainly kings in the ancient world were never elected per se, but the people, you know, want him. So, legabe the malachim, legabe the animals, legabe the stars and the moon and the sun, Hashem is their ruler, but they don't have bechira, they don't have free will. They could not choose to reject God or accept God. So vis-a-vis everything in the Bria, Hashem is a moshel, he's not really a melech. It is only human beings who have the power of free will where they could they could either reject or accept Hashem. That's the power that we have. Mimela, when we accept Hashem, we make Hashem a melech. And mimela, it is only on the sixth day of creation, when Adam HaRishon was created. Of course, Adam HaRishon wound up making the wrong choice. But that's another story. But at least potentially, Adam HaRishon could have made the right choice, so to speak. And therefore, Hashem becomes a melech only when there are human beings who are balei bechira. In fact, the Vilna Gaon writes, this is the meaning of a pasuk that we say after Az Yashir. It's from Nevi'im, Zechariah, ki Lashem hamlucha u'moshel bagoyim. Hashem has melucha, and he's moshel bagoyim. So the Vilna Gaon interprets it this way. The Jewish people who accepted Hashem willingly and with love at Matan Torah made Hashem a melech. The Umos HaOlam who did not accept Hashem and rejected the Torah, Hashem is a Moshel. Ki Hashem hamlucha l'gabi b'nei Yisrael u'moshel bagoy. So that is why the Tehillim Tzadik Gimel is the capital, is the chapter of Tehillim for Friday morning, because Friday, Erev Shabbos, is when the possibility of Malchus first became established. In Adon Olam, which is a very, very famous poem written by Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabarau, who lived in the 1300s, the 14th century. So it says, Lies nasa at Adon Olam Asher Malach b'terem kol yitzir nivra. You were the master of the universe before there were any creations in this universe. But Lies nasa b'cheftso kol, only when everything was completed, including man, azai melech shemo nikra, then and only then did you become a melech. Azai melech shemo nikra. Now, okay, so that kind of explains the basic idea of why this chapter is the Shir Shel Yom of Friday. Why do we then append it, so to speak, to Mizmor Shir Liyom HaShabbos? Because again, we're going to see that it goes on and says, Hashem Malach, God was king, Geus Lavesh, he wore pride. Now we'll have to see what it means to wear pride, and what do you mean, Hashem is a balgai, but chas v'shalom, that wouldn't be the case. But Hashem wears pride, and that means pride is like the nachas, right? When I see my child doing something wonderful, I get pride, my student, etc. So kavyochol, for the 6 days of creation, God was busy creating. On Shabbos, he sits back, and he looks at everything that he created. And that gives him a nachas and a satisfaction. So consequently, the geyus lavesh, the pride of accomplishment, whatever that means, l'gabe Hashem, that is something that is connected to Shabbos, where he looks at the whole Bria, that's all finished, and he sees the shleimus, the perfection of it. He sees how good every single component is, at least potentially. We can ruin it by bechira and the like. So that is the connection to Shabbos. Now, I am not a tremendous gematria fan, because this can drive you crazy. Everything can be gematrias, but it happens to be that the Mekubalim have quite amazing gematrias on some of these psukim. And since it is a short capital anyway, it is only five psukim, so it would be kedai to show you some of the gematrias that it has brought down. It says Hashem Malach Geus, right? Hashem was king, Geus, and had pride and nachas in his bria. So the gematria of the three words Hashem, which is Yud Kei Vav Kei, Hashem Malach Geus, adds up to 425. It's the Sof Tavos. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. In other words, yes, gematrias are an interesting thing. Gematrias work not only by adding all the letters in a word, but you can do sometimes the beginning letters or the middle letters, or the end letters. There's gematrias with the whole word, and there's gematrias besaif teves. So here, Hashem, yud kei vav kei. So the last letter is hey. Melech, last letter is final chaf. So that's 25. Geus, last letter is saf, 400. So the saif teves of the three words, Hashem, Malach, Geus, the saif teves, not the whole thing, is 425. Now, Moshiach ben David adds up to 424. Okay, I'll give you a few seconds to confirm if that's correct, but I think it should be correct. Now, gematria has another rule. There are rules of gematrias that, in addition to the numerical equivalent of the individual letters, you count the whole word as one. That's called imakolel, meaning to say it's 424, and with the kolel of the word, it is 425. And therefore, Hashem Melech Geus Sof Tevos is the same gematria as Mashiach ben Yosef. That's one idea. I'll come back to the significance of that.
Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David.
I'm sorry, Mashiach ben David, Mashiach ben David.
That's three words. Mashiach ben David is three words.
Yeah, so what's wrong with that?
24 and 3 is 127.
Mashiach ben David is 424. Oh, the Kailal. Yeah. So here the Kailal is, you're looking at the whatever base you're using for your gematria. In other words, that's what he's saying. Kailal, if you're using one word, Kailal is one word. If you're using three words, it's a three word. Okay. Now, the Ari goes further. I'll come back and what's the connection here, and makes a point that the two words, Geus Lovesh, he is wearing pride. He is wearing pride. If you rearrange the letters, this is not a gematria, this is a jumble, you can get the words Goel Shabbos. Shabbos is your Redeemer. So taking these two things together, that the Sof Tevos of the first three words, Hashem Malach Geus, is the same gematria as Mashiach ben David with the Kolel, counting the three words as one, and the Arizal Sohara, that Geus Lovesh, if you rearrange the letters, can spell the words Goel Shabbos. So now you see why this is connected to Shabbos, because this is a remes to what the Medrash teaches us, that if the Jewish people were to keep a Shabbos, now this is the Machlokes, remember the Bavli says, if the Jewish people keep two Shabboses, everybody keeps two Shabboses, they will be redeemed, but the Talmud Yerushalmi and some Midrashim say even one Shabbos would be enough to bring Geula. And you see, Taka, that Mashiach ben David plus Goel Shabbos is Merumas in this capital. Now the truth is, if you look at the song of Lecha Dodi, now Lecha Dodi is not Tehillim, although there are many, many verses or expressions from Tehillim that are interspersed in Lecha Dodi. Lecha Dodi was, in fact, it's interesting, I mentioned Lecha Dodi, it's quite unusual. Lecha Dodi was written in the 1500s. In Sfat, by Rav Shlomo Alkabetz, who was a chaver and a fellow mekubal of the Arizal, Rav Moshe Cordovero, all of the great mekubalim were living in Sfat at the same time. And the truth is, it's very, very unusual that a piyut that was written that late, 1500s is late in Jewish history, that late, is mekubal in every single Eda. Chasidim, Misnagdim, Ashkenazim, Sfardim, Taimanim, everybody says Lecha Dodi. In fact, Lecha Dodi actually became more popular than the Tehillim of Kabbalah Shabbos. Other than Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos, Lechun Aranana, all of those Tehillim, there were Kehilos that couldn't say them. But Lecha Dodi, everybody said. So in Lecha Dodi, one point about Lecha Dodi that's interesting is, most of Lecha Dodi is not about Shabbos. It starts off, Shomar V'Zachor, God gave us a commandment to remember Shabbos, observe Shabbos, and there's Likra Shabbos, to greet Shabbos, let us go and greet Shabbos. So the first two stanzas are about Shabbos. Then starting with stanza number three, it's no longer about Shabbos at all. It's about Yerushalayim in a state of Chorban, and there's no Beis HaMikdash, and we yearn for Geula, and we ask Hashem to redeem us. And then we talk about there will be a redemption. And then at the very last verse, we go back to Shabbos again. Bo'i b'shalai ateres bala. Most of the Chadaiti is not about Shabbos. It's about Geula. It's about Mashiach. It's about redemption. Sometimes it's about moaning and crying and the sadness of what we don't have. And other times it's about the jubilation of the Geula. In fact, that's why the Niggun changes. If you're sensitive to it, you'll notice. Again, people aren't always aware of the nuances of the davening for the Amud, but it's often the case that the first part of the Chadodi is sung to a slower Niggun than the second part. Because the first part talks a lot about Chorban and Golos, and then by Lo Seveishi, do not be ashamed, it goes generally into a faster Niggun, because it's a happier thing. But the common denominator is, whether you're talking about the Chorban or whether you're talking about the Geula, it's not about Shabbos. So there are two... So what is the poet doing? Why is he switching topics like this? Starts off with Shabbos, then he talks about Chorban and Geula and Mashiach. So there are two different reasons for this. And both reasons really intersect, can effectively become one reason. Reason number one is that on Shabbos, we experience a sense of what it's like to be in Olam Haba. Shabbos is Me'ein Olam Haba, right? That's what the Zemer says. Me'ein Olam Haba, right? Yom Shabbos Menucha. So, the concept would be, there used to be a, maybe it's still there, there used to be a potato chip commercial, bet you can't eat one. The idea is that once you take one, you know, you have this desire to keep on taking. Ruchnias Kal V'chomer. If we're Zaycha on Shabbos to taste a little bit about what Geula is, then immediately we ask Hashem, give us more, give us more, give us more. And therefore the Chadaiti moves from Shabbos to asking for more Geula. But then, at the end, the poet realizes we're not there yet. And he goes back to Shabbos and says, thank you for Shabbos. So that's one idea, that the Shabbos creates a hisairus, that we yearn for Geula. But the other explanation is what we're saying here, and that is Shabbos itself brings Geula, because Shmiras Shabbos brings Geula. Right, so it's all connected, really. Meaning, Shabbos creates the yearning for Geula, and Shmiras Shabbos Gufa brings the Geula. And Memela, it's an opportune time to think about Mashiach, to think about Olam Haba. That is the Neshama Yisera. The extra soul of Shabbos is the capacity to be connected to Hashem, to feel the connection to Hashem at a more powerful level. So those are the two things. Hashem Malach Geos, 425, is Mashiach ben David Imakailel, and Geos Lavesh is the idea of Goel Shabbos. Now here, and that's the connection to Shabbos here. Now here, though, there's a long, long arichus in many, many svarim, Sifrei Musar, Sifrei Machshava, about the idea that God wears a levush, God wears a garment that is called geos, pride. This is the pride of his creation. So there's a famous passage, and I hope you have learned this. If you haven't, you ought to learn it. It's in many Siddurim. I think it's in the newer Art Scroll Siddurim. This is Igeres HaRamban. Right? Igeres HaRamban, the letter of the Ramban, was a letter that the Ramban wrote when he left his family and came to Eretz Yisrael towards the end of his life. Of course, that's a whole story in and of itself. Why did the Ramban... It's interesting. The Ramban's shita is that living in Eretz Yisrael is a positive chiyuv d'oraisa. That's the Shitas HaRamban. But he didn't come to Eretz Yisrael till he was over 70. And only because he was kicked out of Spain. You know the story. It's a very, very, very fascinating story. He was summoned by the king, King of Aragon, King James, to engage in a public disputation against a Jewish apostate, a Jew who had become Catholic and had become a priest, or a Dominican friar. And this Jew... this renegade Jew wanted to show all the proofs, the same proofs that missionaries use today, that Yashka is Mashiach, etc. And the king ordered the Ramban to defend the Jewish position. And this was like a public debate. This is well known. This is called the Disputation at Barcelona. I think they even have a show, a play about it or something. But it's called Vikuach HaRamban in Hebrew. And we actually have a transcript. The Ramban gave us a transcript of the debate. And it didn't go as well as the priests were hoping. The Catholic clergy were very enthusiastic about scheduling this debate because they figure once and for all Judaism will be discredited, because after all, this Jewish guy also knew some Gemaras and some Midrashim, and they figured that the Ramban would be made a fool of, and Judaism would be discredited as a false religion. Around 3 days into the debate, it wasn't working out that way. The Ramban was quite successful. So they wanted to pull the plug. They told the king, listen, let's just cancel this show. You know, it's not going very well. And the show was canceled prematurely. The debate was never entirely finished. But there was good news for the Ramban and Benners. First of all, the Ramban didn't want to do this at all. The Ramban said, this is a no-win proposition. He said, if Chas V'Shalom, he's discredited, that would be a Chilul Hashem. And if he's successful, he'll get the Jews in trouble because they're discrediting the Catholic Church. So if you win, you're in trouble. If you lose, you're in trouble. It turned out the Ramban was the winner. But indeed, he got so much trouble that there was a big push that there were Catholic clergymen who were very influential, who wanted him killed as a defamer of the faith. King James happened to like the Ramban personally. In fact, he told the Ramban at the end of the debate, I never heard such an eloquent defense of a false position. He says, your position is false, but you defended it tremendously. So the king actually protected the Ramban's life. But even the king was under so much pressure that he had to order the Ramban to get out of Spain, meaning your sentence will be permanent exile. So that's the bad news. The Ramban had to leave his family. The good news was that the Ramban finally decided to come to Eretz Yisrael. And when he came to Eretz Yisrael in the 1200s, he describes a land that was so desolate, so empty, that there was not even a minion of Jews in Yerushalayim. There was not a minion of Jews. They had to make a minion from Hebron and then the Sefer Torah, etc. And he makes the famous observation. This is not in the Geras Ramban, that's the famous one. This is other letters of the Ramban. That he said, that Kala Makudish Mechaveiro, the holier a site is, the more desolate and desecrated it was. And in the old city, near the big fancy Chorva Shul, there's a smaller shul that's called, to this day, Beis Knesses HaRamban, the Ramban Shul. Now, the building is a newer building, but on that site, the Ramban established the Beis Knesses, and that is the oldest continuous Beis Knesses really in the world, other than maybe the Kosel Maravi itself, other than the site of the Kaisel and the like. So there was, except for 19 years, except from 1948 to 1967, Jews have been continuously davening in that particular Makom from the time of the Ramban. So the Ramban did spend the last years of his life in Eretz Yisrael, but it's a bit of a mystery, given the fact that he did have a shita, that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah d'oraisa, then why didn't he come till he was kicked out? So there are a few explanations. We don't really know. The Ramban does not give us an exact reason. But the two reasons that are normally given is, number one, in those days, not like today, the actual travel to Eretz Yisrael was extremely dangerous. You had robbers, you had bandits, you had pirates, you had wild animals. The living conditions in Eretz Yisrael also were extremely dangerous because Eretz Yisrael was being torn apart. These are the later crusades between Christians and Muslims, etc. So, which was dangerous. You could get killed at any moment in different communities. Because the Muslims hated Jews and the Christians hated Jews, so it's not, you're really between two enemies, both of whom want to kill you. So the Pashtus, Pikuach Nefesh exempted you from going, right, if you didn't have to go. And the other reason that's given is that in the day, certainly in the days before email or telephones or whatever, the Ramban was the Gadol Hador, and the Ramban needed to be accessible and available to the people that would ask him shailas. In Eretz Yisrael, you were kind of out of commission. I mean, even today, when you're not out of commission, you know, there are heterim that Rabbonim or whatever stay in Chutz La'aretz because they need to be connected to the people that need them, Kal V'chomer, in those days. You know, the Chafetz Chaim wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. I mean, the Chafetz Chaim was in his 80s, around after World War I. He wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Chaim Ozer sent a delegation of Gedolim to tell the Chafetz Chaim, you are not allowed to leave. You are not allowed to leave because we need you. We need you here. We cannot be abandoned. This is before the Holocaust. This is after World War I. So there was such a concept. As they say, you know, this is a hard question that all, you know, rabbis, teachers, you know, have to balance with. So you have to be careful, on one hand, not to be too arrogant. A person can never feel, oh, without me, the Jewish community is going to fall apart. I have to stay. Usually they'll do okay. What do they say? This is the famous rabbinical joke, that when rabbis go on vacation, they are afraid of two things. One is that the shul will fall apart, and the other is they'll do great. That's also a fear. So a person has to be modest. But there are rabbanim that I know who actually were given a psak by Gedolim that they were not allowed to leave their positions in Chutz La'aretz because they were needed. And certainly that was the case of the Ramban. Yeah?
What was in Hebron? You mentioned that there were Jews in Hebron, that the Ramban...
There were Jews in Hebron, too. In other words, there were small pockets of Jews everywhere. In fact, the largest Jewish community, which was several hundred, was all the way in Akko up north a little bit. That was a relatively large community. That had around 300 families, and they were the Balei HaTosfos from France. And in fact, the Ramban spent his first Rosh Hashanah in Eretz Yisrael. He spent it in Akko. He went up to Akko. And we have a famous drasha. The Ramban has a drasha on Rosh Hashanah. He was honored to give a drasha to the Balei HaTosfos, right? Up there in Akko. And I have to say that people in those days may have had more patience, you know, because if you look at, assuming that the Ramban's written drasha is reflective of his oral drasha that was given orally, it would take at least 3 hours to give that drasha. So either people had more patience, or if the Ramban is giving a drasha, you have patience to listen. But the Ramban did not stay in Akko. The Ramban eventually went back to Yerushalayim, and he tried to create a little bit of kila. So there were some Jews in Hebron, there were Jews in Yerushalayim, but the main Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael was in Akko, from the Balei HaTosfos, who had come 50 years before the Ramban. The reason why Akko was safer, again, it's a strange thing, because the history changes every week at that time. That is, Akko in the north was under Christian control at the time, and Yerushalayim and Hebron was under Islamic control. And at that particular conjunction, which changed, because the Akko community was totally wiped out in the next crusade, but at that particular juncture, Christian rule happened to be more benign than Islamic rule. But that changed. The Akko community, which was the biggest, was totally decimated a few years later. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just lost the thread a little bit. What was the connection between Rambam and the Chayav to live Ramban in Eretz Yisrael?
No, the reason is Ramban. Ramban.
Ramban and Tehillim 93?
No, I'm getting to it. This is 11. I'm getting there. It's a little rough. Okay. So, that's a little... I want to introduce you to the Ramban a little bit. Okay. Now, one of the things the Ramban wrote when he was in Eretz Yisrael is he wrote a letter to his family that is called Igeres HaRamban, the letter of the Ramban. It's a very short letter. It's only around 2 pages. Many, many Siddurim have it printed in Hebrew, and Art Scroll, the newer Art Scroll, has with an English translation as well. And there are even commentaries written, like on the Igeres HaRamban. You can buy a book that goes through Igeres HaRamban. It's only a two-page letter. And it is really one of the most beautiful, short, musar books that you can learn about how to be an ethical person, how to be a godly person, how to be a righteous person. And the one theme that the Ramban mentions more than anything is the quality of humility, the quality of not having pride. And he says that every single person that you meet, you should always try to identify qualities in them that you can admire, that you don't fully have. He says, and even if somebody is less religious than you, less observant than you, less knowledgeable of the Torah than you, the Ramban says, you can always ask yourself, if you would have had the circumstances of his life, maybe you would not have been as good as he is. Meaning, yeah, if you know a lot of Torah, it's maybe because you had certain opportunities that the other person didn't have. And therefore, the Ramban makes the point that humility is what opens your heart to be connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So now, the connection to Tehillim 93 is the Ramban says the following. Anyone who has gaiva is misappropriating the cloak that belongs to the Almighty. And he says, because it says, Hashem malach geus lavesh. This quality of pride, of course we'll have to explain that, this quality of pride belongs to the Almighty. It is His garment. And essentially, therefore, you're wearing the garment of the King. You're misappropriating the garment of the King, and one who misappropriates the garment of the King is Chayiv Misa. Again, that's just very beautiful. The Ramban talks about speaking in a quiet, gentle voice, looking at people in a favorable way. As I say, even if they're not as accomplished as you, to understand that people have difficulties in life and you don't know how well you would have done had you gone through all that they have gone through. He mentions another thing in the Igaris as well, which is not relevant to this, but I'll mention that as an aside. He says, whenever you learn something in Torah, this is quite a challenge actually, you should always get up immediately after you learn and think, how can I put this into practical action? Now, sometimes that's a little hard because a lot of things we learn in Gemara are very, very abstract and they're not necessarily dealing with anything practical. Like you're learning Kedushin, right? So what? Okay, I'm getting married. The first girl that I see, I'm going to give her a ring and say, Harei Atma Kedushin. Or even better, I'll give her a penny or I'll give her a shekel because that I want to show the halacha that you marry a girl with the pruta. How do you apply it? And that's going to be a challenge, but that requires a certain creativity. And he says that you try to take everything that you learn and try to apply it, even in a small way, to the way you're going to live your life. So that's the Ramban's famous point, that you're wearing chaluko, the garment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So here, one of the Svarim says, this is an amazing gematria that's going to blow your mind. Again, I'm not normally a gematria fan. This may be the only shir I'm going to use these gematrias because the Tehillim is so short. But the gematrias are very, very amazing. Let's take the gematria of the word katan. Katan means small, insignificant. The gematria of katan is 159. Then take the opposite of katan, gadol, great. The gematria of gadol is 43. So first of all, you see an interesting paradox. The katan is greater than the gadol. Right? Because the katan is 159, and the gadol is only 43. Now that itself is an interesting observation, that the gematria of katan is greater than gadol, that shows you. But here's the other thing. The difference between 159 and 43 is 116. Okay? The gematria of Hashem Malach is 116. Which means the difference between a katan and a gadol is the katan has made Hashem his king. Because if you add 116 to gadol, you get katan. Meaning to say, when there's humility, you truly make God your king. When there's gaiva, you're banishing Hashem from your life because you become the center of everything. And so it's an amazing thing. Katan is 159 again. Gadol is 43. The difference between the two is 116. 116 is the gematria of Hashem Malach. And the same thing is true with another pair. This is amazing. Anava, humility, is 181. I'm sorry, 131. 131. Anava. 131. Gaiva is only 15. The difference in Anava and Gaiva is 116, the gematria of Hashem Malach. And this is something...
Between what?
Huh? Anava and Gaiva. In other words, the difference between Katan and Gadol is 116, and the difference in Anava and Gaiva is 116. Both of them are the gematria of Hashem Malach. Yeah, this is really an absolutely amazing, amazing gematria. But it goes back to the Gemara in Satan. Now, Chazal don't fool around with gematrias that much, but Chazal make the statement in Maseches Saita that when you are a Baal Gaiva, you are driving Hashem out of the world. That's what it says. A Baal Gaiva is dochek, pushes, raglei hashchina. Hashem says, ein ani vahu yecholin lador b'olam echad. Hashem says, I and he, the world is not big enough for both of us. And Hashem leaves. Hashem leaves the world. Again, I mean, obviously not completely, but there's a reduction of the hashras hashchina in the world. Right? So that's Hashem Malach Geyos Lovesh. But now, and again, the pasuk says, Tayaras Hashem, pasuk in Mishlei, Tayavas Hashem, call Gavalev an abomination. It is hated, disgusting. Toeva is a very strong word. Toeva doesn't just mean forbidden. Toeva, disgusting, an abomination, repulsive. That's how much Hashem hates the Baal Gaiva. But then we get into an interesting problem, because on one hand, we're supposed to emulate Hashem's midos. So if the pasuk says, Hashem Malach, Geyos Lovesh. So I imitate Hashem by Geyos Lovesh, right? So here, it's an interesting thing. We do find good Gaiva and bad Gaiva. For example, the Pasuk says in Malachim, it describes one of the righteous kings of Yehuda, Yehoshaphat. And it says, Vayigba Libai, Bedarchei Hashem. His heart was high. Vayigba, his heart was proud in his Avodas Hashem. He felt accomplished. That means what? That when a person does mitzvahs, he should be happy. He should feel that Baruch Hashem, I'm doing something good. There's a difference between what you might call pride and what you might call arrogance, even though in English they are more or less synonymous. Arrogance is when you attribute all your success to you, you look down at others, you see the flaws of other people, and you think you're better, so much better than them. Good pride, vayigba libo darchei Hashem, is when you have a healthy self-esteem that Baruch Hashem, I'm accomplishing. In fact, this is why the Chazon Ish had a little bit of a criticism with the Musar movement. I mean, he admired the Gedolei Musar, he knew them, and he said they were Gedolei Mamish. But he said there was a little problem with the Musar movement. The Chazon Ish felt that the Musar movement was so introspective that it made people always feel that they were deficient. In other words, you do a mitzvah, I didn't have enough kavanah. In other words, there's this constant cheshbon ha-nefesh. Now, on one hand, you need a cheshbon ha-nefesh. But the Chazon Ish said that took away some of the simcha a person should have in Avodas Hashem. So the Chazon Ish actually felt a person always has to work on himself. But it shouldn't be like so self-conscious. He shouldn't constantly be re-examining, oh, was my mincha really good? Again, I mean, if you look at certain exercises of Musar, there's this constant going over and over and over. Did I daven a mincha with kavana because I really had kavana, or because I wanted my chavrusa to see how I daven mincha? You know, they go through all of these calculations over and over and over and over again. The Chazon Ish felt it could be very negative for some people. So there is vayigba libay bedarchei Hashem. Yeah.
Did the Chazanish write this?
He didn't write. He didn't write it as explicitly as I said it, but it does come across. But what I said is what he said bal peh, and in Emunah u'Bitachon, there's some clear remuzim to this. First of all, Emunah u'Bitachon was itself a censored sefer. You have to know. Although I think now they may have reprinted everything. Emunah u'Bitachon took out the original versions until very, very recently. Took out whole passages where the Chazon Ish was critical of certain shitas in Amunah, and it was thought that that would hurt people, but they put it back in more recent editions. We have another passage, the Gemara says. A Talmud Chacham has to have what is called a Shmini Shebishminis of Gaiva. That means 1/8 of 1/8. I'll give you a chop in the ground that. A little bit of gaiva. You have to have some pride. You have to stand up for Kavanah Torah. You can't let people walk all over you. People will be mevaze the Torah. Shemini shebishminis. Now, it's interesting that there's a famous, great pshat from the Vilna Gaon. Why do Chazal use the phrase shemini shebishminis? If they just mean a little measure, there's a lot of terms you could use for little measures. Why an eighth of an eighth? So the Vilna Gaon says, the remes here is, look at the eighth pasuk of the eighth parsha. And that'll tell you what type of gaiva the Talmud Chacham has to have. So, what's the eighth pasuk of the eighth parsha? So let's see. We have Reishis, Noach, Lech Lecha, Vayera, Chayesara, Toldos, Vayetze, Vayishlach. Vayishlach is eighth parsha. Okay, we then look at eighth pasuk when Yaakov is praying that Hashem should save him from Esav. So Yaakov says at some point, "Katonti mikol hachasadim, I am undeserving of all of your loving kindness, Hashem." So the Vilna Gaon says, when the Talmid Chacham has gaiva, it is not a personal gaiva for his own honor and his own glory. But he stands up like Yaakov Avinu, who says, "I'm not worthy," and it's all for the glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Shemini Shebishminis is the Katayinti Mikol HaChasadim, the eighth pasuk of the eighth parsha. Then we have a third mimer. This is the famous mimer that each person, right? The Mishnah says in Sanhedrin, why did Hashem create only one man? One man or one woman. He created many cows and many dogs. The answer is, so each person should look at himself and say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, the world was created just for me. In other words, you have to look at yourself as so significant, so important, so cherished and treasured by the Almighty, that the whole universe would be justified even if you were the only person in it. Now, Rav Bunin of Prashischa was a Hasidic Rebbe. A lot of people think this is a medrash. The actual formulation is not. Rav Bunin of Prashischa, great Hasidic Rebbe of the 19th century, said a person has to have two ideas in his pocket at all times. One is Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, because of me, the whole universe was created. In the other pocket, you have the idea, Anochi Afor V'Efer, I'm dust and ashes. So you've got to live with both of those ideas at the same time. You have to know your Madrega. You have to know your Chashivas. You have to know this. Because if a person thinks they're nothing and they're worthless and they can't accomplish, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and you never become the person that you need to become. So this is the great challenge. On one hand, as the Ramban writes, going back to 93 and the Igeres Ramban, Gaiva, Geus, belongs only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Our job is to be humble. Our job is to recognize. In fact, being humble, someone once said, very good, being humble is not like a fake thing. being humble is simply recognizing the truth of our situation. It's not like, I'm really great, but I'm humble. It's to really understand that we are really nothing. Can't be the glory of Hashem. But at the same time, know that Hashem gave us kochos, and Hashem gave us powers, and Hashem gave us abilities. And we have to use them, and what we do matters. And Hashem loves us. Rav Tzadok writes, just as a person has to have emunah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he has to have emunah in himself. In himself. And the Bali Musar said, if a person is not aware of their faults, they are a fool. They're an idiot. But if you're not aware of your greatness, you're a tragedy. Because you'll never become what you're able to become. Right? So this is a complex balancing, as it were. That on one hand, the gaiva belongs to Hashem. But on the other hand, we are supposed to emulate aspects of it. To recognize our kochos, because after all, our divine souls are sparks from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now here too, the Bali Musar make another nice observation. They point out that even Legabe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the geus is described as a lavush, a garment. It's not that Hashem is miskoya. Hashem has a lavush of geus. Now the quality of a garment is you are poshet for lovesh, depending on what you need at any given time. You put on the garment, or you take it off. So there are times in which Hashem behaviorally has to behave in what might seem a prideful way, for justice or whatever it is. But that's not intrinsic. That is a levush. So too for us, if we need to be miskoya for discipline or for whatever it would be, it's a levush that you're poshet for lovesh. They say this by the Chafetz Chaim, by anger. It's the same point. That the Chafetz Chaim was learning, and there were people who were disturbing, they were making noise, and they were creating all sorts of disruptions. And the Chafetz Chaim, seemingly very angrily, told them how they have to stop it. And he seemed to be very upset. And immediately after the people left, the Chafetz Chaim was learning as if nothing happened at all. Now we know in our own lives, when we get angry, it takes a while to calm down. We don't just go from extreme anger to nothing happened. So the person asked the Chafetz Chaim, how is it you're talking? You were so upset a minute ago, and now there's nothing. He said he wasn't upset. He said he needed to use anger to discipline and give appropriate musar to the people. So it was like a coat. He put on the coat, and then he took off the coat. It was not a loss. For most people, most of the time, anger is really a loss of control. At least temporarily, we just lose control. We might describe it as righteous indignation, we might describe it as l'shem shamayim, but we just lose control. But to the true person, who understands that every midah is like a color on a palette, like the painter takes this color, I'm switching metaphors there, this color, this coat, that coat, that coat. You use it as long as you need it, and then you put it away. And that's the lashon of geus lovesh, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wears geus, but he's poshet. He simply takes it off, he's poshet for lovesh. In that way, we too can emulate Hashem's ways. We can sometimes use the midah when we need it, but it can never become part of us. If it becomes part of us, it becomes very destructive. And finally, I'll mention one more Maimer Chazal. It mentions how a Talmud Chacham sometimes has to be very vigilant for his honor. He should be no kaim the noter. He should avenge his honor, ken nachash, like a snake. And that seems to be attack. So here's what some Mefarshim say. Again, a beautiful analogy. Hashem cursed the snake that the snake eats dirt, although we don't know what that means exactly in modern sense, but the snake eats dirt. Now, dirt doesn't have much of a taste. So the snake does not enjoy what it does. It just does it. So that's the dimyon. if you want to stand up and defend Kavodat Torah, it has to be something you don't enjoy doing. If you enjoy doing it, then you're doing it for your own kavod or to hurt other people. So if you're like the snake, then it's legitimate. If you're not like the snake, then it is not legitimate. Okay, so this is the idea of geos lavesh, that God wears pride. It's connected to Shabbos once again, because Shabbos Hashem surveys the beauty of the creation, and therefore there is a sense of nachas, of satisfaction, of joy in the shleimus of the bria. Now, it culminates again. I'll have a few more comments. I just want to finish look at the last pasuk for a moment, and it says. Now, actually, a little before that, it says, "The rivers raise their voice. The rivers raise their voice in destruction. But greater than the sound of all of this powerful water, more mighty than the waves of the sea, is the mightiness of Hashem above." So Rashi explains that the reference to the torrential waters is metaphorical. It's not intended to be literal. And it refers to the Umos HaOlam, who deny God and want to destroy the Jewish people. And they are like tsunamis. They are like torrential waters that want to sweep away everything that is good. So it says, the rivers raise their voice. The voice, the sound of the rivers are the breaking waves. And they want to dachyam, they want to break us. They're breaking. But greater than those rivers is the ultimate mightiness of God. And therefore, David HaMelech is Merames here, that there will be enemies of Hashem, there will be enemies of the Jewish people. There are times that we will feel that we're being swept away. But there is something more powerful than even the most powerful of waters. And that is the Adir Bamarom, the Mighty One, that is in Marom, in the heavens. And it ends with this comfort, because again, Shabbos, which gives us a taste of Geula, gives us faith in the coming of Mashiach. Eidosecha nemnu miot. Your testimonies, meaning your promises that there will be Geula, nemnu miot, are very faithful. We have faith that they're going to happen. Leveischa nava kodesh. Right, your edus, your promises regarding your holy dwelling are very nemnu. They are very trustworthy to us. Hashem, even if it'll be li'orech yamin meaning even if it'll be a very long time. Right, that's how you read it. Edosecha nemnu miot. Your promises are faithful. We trust them. We believe them for the restoration of your holy house, even if it will be li'orech yamim, even if it will be long in the future. Now, again, historically, there's a little bit of a problem here. Who wrote this? Now, technically, this is still the 11 kapitlach that Chazal are miyachas to Moshe Rabbeinu. So technically, according to Chazal, this is Moshe Rabbeinu. So if it's Moshe Rabbeinu, obviously there was no Beis HaMikdash yet. If it was David HaMelech, there was no Beis HaMikdash yet. But again, the assumption would be that many Tehillim are written as prophecies. They express Ruach HaKodesh. And David HaMelech, or Moshe Rabbeinu certainly, put into the Tehillim the idea that there would be powerful torrential waters that would seek to sweep us away and destroy us. But even as that is happening, we know that there's something more powerful than that water, and that all of Hashem's promises will happen, even if they are li'orech yamim, even if it'll be a long time. Meaning, we're not going to give up. The fact that things didn't happen right away and things didn't happen for 2,000 years, we don't give up. And once again, the connection to Shabbos is because Shabbos awakens that spark of hope in the Jewish soul, because it gives us a feeling of what that Geula is like. And therefore, it's interesting that as we begin Shabbos, we mention this idea, just like the Chadodi, it's the same idea, that from Shabbos we move to the idea of yearning for redemption. It could be that maybe that's why Rav Shlomo Alkibitz wrote the poem that way, because that is how this Tehillim goes. It moves from Shabbos, which is the Geus Lavesh, the supervising the creation, to a Dosecha Nemnu Ma'od, we have trust that your ultimate promises are going to be fulfilled, no matter how long it takes. Okay, so we'll stop here and have to spend a great time.